Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is our final session for the conference. I must say it's been a great pleasure to be with all of you today, and I appreciate all your time, many great discussions that we've had. What I'd like to talk about in this final session is some next steps, not just for LAMS, but really for the wider learning design field. And I've characterized this as bug fixes, branching, and pedagogic planners, and I'll try and unpack those a little bit for you as we go along. I do want to start, though, by talking a little bit about the promise of learning design, which many of us have touched on during today, and from that, to just talk a bit about this challenge of representational frameworks. What is it we are representing, and how, and what challenges do we have in that area? Because that, to me, still seems to be of fundamental significance, and I'm not at all sure that we've got to the bottom of those issues. I'll then talk a little bit about the technology challenges of learning design systems. Bug fixes is kind of just an easy handle for that. But there are some problems for anyone who would design a system, not just LAMS, that I want to unpack a bit. And then I want to talk a little bit about some more flexible structures, certainly for LAMS, and I think also for learning design generally. And I want to do the first live public demo of the new branching feature that we have coming. Sadly, not to be released today. We haven't got all the bugs fixed, but I will show it to you running live and at least indicate some of where that is headed. And then lastly, I want to touch on pedagogic planners, as we have also talked about quite a bit today, and to reflect a bit on that, and much of what I've got to say touches the discussions we've had today, so I hope that will be useful. Well, the promise of learning design, for me at least, is the potential that when we think about good practice in teaching and learning, what we hope to get out of learning design is that we will be able to describe that practice. That's part of it. That we can run that practice where running it in software makes sense, and often it won't, but where that's relevant. And particularly, I think one of the things that drives many of us is the idea that we might reuse and share. That by capturing good practice, it is not merely for the individual teacher's use. It is something that as we distribute that among lecturers and school teachers and others, that we might help to improve the quality of education overall by helping people to get access to, you know, good practice. I think also the idea that we can improve good practice, that we can take existing examples and adapt them, modify them and improve them. So there's not merely that someone sits and from on high develops a great learning design and then pushes it out, but rather a much more grassroots collaborative effort where we help each other to make these things better with time. Certainly an important part of the dream. And ultimately, and something that Diana has touched on a number of times, is the potential to research and critique learning designs in the same way that in the scientific process we research and critique, you know, key research ideas, that we would bring that to our teaching and learning. And that by representing in a shareable way learning designs, we can finally now, with perhaps more rigour, critique them and research their impact in practice, and through that iterate back to changing and improving them. You know, that our improvements of learning designs in the future will be not merely, as a practitioner, I think it would be better if you did X. But in fact, we might be able to say, here is a known learning design, and here is the literature of evidence about its impact on student learning, and those bits that, you know, work well and those that don't, and therefore it suggests what we might change. We might change that and then rerun that research with students and look for evidence that the change has led to genuine improvements. And there's a tendency in educational research to focus very much on quantitative measures for this kind of thing, you know, improved test scores and so on. And that's not to say it will be irrelevant, but I think much of the evidence we will find one day will be far more narrative and qualitative. You know, the types of postings that people put in their discussion forums are different in these ways when the design is structured, you know, accordingly. So that, I think, is part of what we're all here for, is to try and just, you know, capture and to share and to improve good teaching and learning. It's, you know, what it's really about. And so you might fairly ask, well, don't we already do this? You know, have we not got whole departments of education and educational research that do this every day of the week? And I mean, it's fair to say that we are certainly trying to do these things. But there are two particular problems, for me at least, that are why learning design as a new field has such promise. And one of them is that much of e-learning has been a very content transmission view of the education process. And that narrowing of focus, I think, has been quite unfortunate for us in the sort of 5 or 10 years that we've been doing sort of particularly web-based e-learning, in that we've achieved a great deal in that area, and yet we seem to have this big blind spot when it comes to activities, particularly group activities, and the sharing of group activities. So I think that that narrow content transmission model is one problem that needs addressing if we're going to truly share good teaching and learning processes. And the second and partly related thing is that we don't really have a widely adopted representational framework for the teaching and learning process, regardless of whether it's implemented in technology or entirely face-to-face or a mixture of both. We still haven't got, you know, sort of the models that are at least widely adopted. We have our first attempt at them, but we're still some distance from that. And I want to reflect on that one a little bit with reflections from two other areas. When I finished my schooling, I studied music to senior level, and I seriously considered a career in music. And so part of my background is a love and passion for music. And in the history of the, you know, Western music tradition, and particularly the notation of it, you know, a score of music, it took some time to develop a way of representing what music was. And it wasn't really until the Baroque period of music, or sort of just before it, that we finally sorted out both pitch and rhythm into a unified structure that means you could convey to another person what you meant when you wrote a piece of music or when you tried to pass it on. And I think there's even some arguments to say that it was the fact that we got that representational mechanism in place that then led to a great flourishing in music, because you could finally teach people music at a distance. You didn't need a hands-on experience to do it. You could give them the score and they could read it and so on. And something that more I've reflected on this that's really struck me is that music notation is not complete. It is not a notation of everything you might want to know about a piece of music. Now, as a musician, you regularly talk about your interpretation, the way that you would play a piece of music. And partly what you're doing is you're looking at the score as it stands and then reading into it some of the things that you think the original composer might have meant, but which are not written down. You know, go slightly faster here, slow back a little bit here. And it's not to say you can't put some of these things in. But in a typical score, there's quite a bit of information that's missing from it that is left to the performer to consider, to interpret. And from that I draw the idea that our job for developing a representational framework for education does not mean we have to represent every possible thing. We just need to represent enough that we can convey our intent to others so that they can replicate and interpret and, you know, put their own meaning onto that. And what I find fascinating is that I can look at a score, certainly because of my musical background, from the past and know exactly what the composer intended, and I could potentially go and play it, you know, if it was within my skills. This is an example I find fascinating. On the left is an earlier manuscript before the notational system of music sort of solidified. It has some of the proto-elements in it. You'll notice it's got the four-line stave, it's got some dots, but rhythm is quite unclear within it, and also pitch is not clear. And the truth is, I couldn't sing that or do that music for you looking at it like that. I could, you know, maybe guess at what some of it is, but I really don't know what the composer's intent is when I look at that. But on the right is an example from one of Bach's pieces. And when I look at that, even though it's some hundreds of years in distance, and I never knew Bach, you know, I know nothing of the man, I can read that and play that. And I can even guess at the interpretations to put on top of that piece of music, because the structured information, the representational framework, is at least sufficient, may not be complete, but sufficient that I know what that means. Now, for those of you without a music background, you may be looking at that going, like, it's great for you, James, but I don't know what that means, and fair enough. But at least in the context of music, there was a significant shift from some attempts at representation, which were of some use but not yet sufficient, to a point where we suddenly hit where we could capture at least a great deal. And I should say, there are still certain types of music which are very hard to represent within that particular Western system, and I don't want to pretend that there are no issues here. Nonetheless, a great deal of music is representable given the sort of basic elements that provides. If music isn't your thing, and given that we are here at the University of Greenwich, I thought that perhaps a little nautical terminology might be of interest to you. I've had the great fortune and also the curse to start reading the Patrick O'Brien novels in the past 6 months, and they have, you know, consumed a huge amount of my productive working life. But any of you who have come across these novels will know that from pretty much page one of the first novel, the nautical terminology in these is very rich, and it represents quite a barrier to getting into it. I have a few examples down the bottom. If you'd like to tell me what a futtock or a loblolly boy are, welcome to. And the problem is that Patrick O'Brien actually writes about this issue in one or two of his commentaries, and he says, well, but this is what the things are called. You know, I can't tell you about what happens on a man of war, a ship from the age of sail, without referring to all these things, because that's what they were. You know, to call them something else would be to fail to convey to you how a ship really operated. And so you either essentially have to step into that world and begin to understand that language, or accept that you won't really know what's going on. And so another representational system where, as an author, essentially Patrick O'Brien has said, well, you know, I have to stick with the words that as they are, what they really describe. So what I take from this is that in terms of the promise of learning design, the original work of Educational Modelling Language by Rob Koper and colleagues at the Open University of the Netherlands, the IMS Learning Design Specification, LAMS and the way that LAMS works, and a range of others are, you know, they are our early attempts at a representational framework for the teaching and learning process. That's what I think we are trying to do here. You know, there's also machine stuff, there's XML and there's e-learning, but really I think what we're trying to get at is some sort of representational process. And if the history of music is a guide, I think we can take some solace that it's not necessarily for it to be complete. We don't have to try and represent every possible thing, but we do need to replicate enough that we can convey the intent of one educator to another. When I go to try and teach a certain class in a certain way, I want to describe that to you with sufficient information that you could do something similar. You can also interpret some of my intent as an educator. And I think it's worth acknowledging here that to read music, there is a certain amount of basic training. You do need to learn what the notation means. And whether this is an issue we will need to face in the field of learning design. You know, LAMS in many ways has tried to make the barrier to entry as small as possible. You know, it's certain boxes written on a page, but that very much limits the amount of information that can convey. And so perhaps over the next 5 or 10 years, we will start to work through what is a sufficiently rich descriptive framework that is not so difficult to learn that everyone will give up on it, and yet is not so simplistic as to miss vital elements. And if we can get to that point, we can then start to work out what is an appropriate amount of training that we would require of an educator, you know, as a professional, to be able to read and interpret and understand these representations. Well, that to me seems like a worthy question for us to consider in the coming years. And I just want to say some brief words about LAMS in the context of that. You know, LAMS is an attempt to represent the teaching and learning process. It's inspired by IMS Learning Design, as has been often said. And it's also a software system to run activities in an e-learning environment. And those of you who haven't seen, in LAMS version 2, this is now made explicit. Any activity can be set to what we call run offline. That is, this task, if it were a forum, will not launch a forum. It will just give your students a message that says, you're doing this face-to-face, go see your teacher to find out what to do. And the system might then have records of advice or even documents for the teacher that says, when you run this forum face-to-face, here is some advice on how to run it. Here are some worksheets perhaps you might want to use with students. So since the launch of LAMS version 2, this idea of a general representational mechanism, whether or not you deliver any task over a computer, is at least part of the ideas we have here. And I think one of the issues is we've always tried to work a lot on the sort of learning design enabled tools as a key part of what we did with LAMS. That was always one of our strong areas of focus. And it wasn't just that we then wanted to make it easy to run with students, although this is obviously of critical importance. But in fact, if you can't see how it's going to look as an educator, you don't get the iterative process. So if I design a flow of activities, I need to, you know, hit a button and see what that might look like so that I can then iterate, change, and so on. So to me, the need to be able to, you know, instantiate those tools at least in some way so you can see, oh, the forum will come here and it'll look like this and a chat might come here and so on. That to me seemed an important part of the process from day one. Without that, we wouldn't get quite the same iterative reflection on our learning designs. And one last thing about LAMS is that the visual nature of its authoring environment, the sort of drag and drop, has been one of its, you know, things that many people have noted and found striking. And I think it's worth pointing out that it is not merely a convenience. There is something quite deep about this representation as a visual flow of the teaching process. You know, I've seen too many evaluations of teachers' experience of using LAMS. I've talked to too many educators to think that this is just sort of, yeah, it's kind of handy that, oh, you can sort of see the boxes. it actually seems to help educators to think more deeply about the flow of teaching and learning in a way that a non-visual process doesn't seem quite as strong. I don't want to say that it's sort of the ultimate method, or that it's, that there's no other visualizations that would be useful. It's far from that. But just this sort of, the current visualization has had quite some impact on the way people think. So that's just a few reflections from me about this sort of issue of representing good teaching and learning and where I think we've got to, and perhaps some indicators of where we might go in the future. For those of you who haven't seen LAMS, that's just a screenshot from the authoring environment that gives a sense of that sort of visual flow. This is the bedside manner sequence I've been doing over the last few months, ever since I went and presented at a medical conference and discovered that, you know, people doing medical education were quite taken with this sort of approach. So the second thing I want to talk about a bit is some of the technology challenges of learning design. And I'm not going to talk about, you know, Java classes and XML. I want to talk at a high level about these things. And I think my sense is that technology to do learning design has proved to be far more challenging to build than anyone really suspected. You know, I remember being in the IMS Learn Design specification group towards the end of it back in 2002, and then when the specification released. And I think many of us had a sense that we would rapidly see the arrival of these fantastic learning design systems, and we would, you know, be able to do all this work quite quickly. And that's not what happened. It proved to be very difficult to get these systems to work and to be robust and to be easy to use. And to be honest, if one knows this field closely, you know that there are just many failed software projects littered in its history. And not many people want to talk about it, and that's very understandable. But the truth is that it has proved very difficult to do. And I point this out not to say that any project that failed is bad. Far from it. I'm trying to say this is a really hard thing to do in software. And it's not surprising that we have struggled, because at its heart, a learning design system, I believe, is a kind of new type of workflow system. And it's a workflow system that steps groups of people through, you know, a series of tasks. And in the, you know, billion-dollar workflow, you know, system for businesses, this has never been done. This concept of groups of people going through workflows is not what workflow systems today tend to do. They tend to do machine processes or one-off human processes, but not this group concept. And so we in the field of education, in the subcontext of learning design, are actually trying to build a type of workflow system that the best in the business who do it all day long have not yet done. And so I think we should at least feel not so bad, perhaps, if this has proved challenging to do. And certainly when I think of all the challenges we've had in building LAMS over the years and the amount of time and effort and money it's taken, I take some small heart from the fact that we seem to be breaking some quite fundamental new software ground, independent of its importance to teaching and learning. And those of you who know LAMS version 1, a number of you presented today, I think most people know this, but it started out as an R&D prototype. And to be honest, when we were first building it, we did not know whether it was possible to build it as a piece of software. You know, when we were in the project in the first 6 months building it, we literally thought there was every chance we would get nothing out the other end, that this thing we were trying to build would prove just so difficult that it wasn't achievable. And I remember well that sense of, you know, we might have nothing to show after the initial work. But we were lucky that we made a certain number of decisions that kind of narrowed the scope of what it was, that helped us to get a system out in a relatively short time. And then people got quite excited about what it did educationally. But it's worth saying, and a number of you know this, that the software underneath that resulted from that process left a lot to be desired. It was not the most robust and scalable and lovely software. And it had some quite significant bugs in it. And more importantly, many of the bugs were ones that we could not get to the bottom of. When people would use LAMS, it would crash in some way, they'd tell us that it crashed, we would go in the technical team and go and look. We couldn't find where it is, and it's not because we didn't look hard enough, and it's not because, you know, Ernie and others were not bright enough, okay? Very bright. It's just it was a really hard piece of software to get to the bottom, partly because it had grown sort of higgledy-piggledy, partly because it was just a really tough area. And so I think a number of other projects who found it's very hard to get a stable learning design system have had this same experience in this area, and it's just because it's, you know, it's a tough bit of software. So from that, firstly, my sincere apologies to everyone who's been out there with LAMS version 1 in the field and has gone horribly wrong, and you've had to do sort of the soft shoe shuffle for your students to make up something else. We did our best, but it was a very hard thing, and I am so thankful to those who sort of stuck with us in spite of these, you know, challenges, because it's helped us to get further. And in late 2004, we reached the point within the LAMS team where we started to rebuild it from the ground up. And it took us over 2 years to do that, but in late last year, we released LAMS version 2. And what's interesting about version 2 LAMS is it's got certain new features, which is nice. But architecturally, you know, as a piece of software, it was radically rebuilt. It has very little in common under the hood with the first version. And we tried to do it as cleanly and modularly as possible, and also in a way that we could go hunting for bugs. So when something does go wrong with LAMS version 2, I want you to really tell us, and tell us with some hope that we might fix it, unlike in the earlier days, because the depth to which we have to dive to try and find that bug is nowhere near as great as it was in version 1. So I know it's a big ask to say, I know you've had many not so great experiences, but now it's all good, and please try again and then tell us if it doesn't work. But all I can say is that that is where we're at. And there is in fact a system that we use within the LAMS project called Jira that tracks every one of the bugs we know about. They're all publicly there. You can go and look at them. You can talk to Ernie about becoming a bug tester and actually adding bugs and so on. So we're doing as much as I think we reasonably can to get to highly scalable, robust learning design system. For those of you who haven't seen it, this is sort of the architectural view of the LAMS version 2, and I don't want to talk at great length about technology. The one thing I want to pull out is that each of the activity tools in LAMS version 2 is pretty much its own little standalone application. So the forum, the quiz, the chat, they each stand as their own module, and we did that because we had a hope that over time software developers would start to build their own tools for LAMS and be able to just drop those in as a relatively modest piece of work, without having to understand all of the detail of what goes on the back end. And there are a couple of people who are starting to do that now. It's still early days, but we still have hopes that people will start to develop additional tools, additional features to what we've got. I'm particularly keen on discipline-specific tools. People who start to develop tools, you know, perhaps a chemistry modelling tool that would be great in chemistry, but you might not use in any other field. These are some of the hopes we have for the future and why we built the architecture in this particular way. And one last technical thing to touch on, and it's come up a few times today, is the integration of a learning design system with a learning management system or virtual learning environments. And this has quite a history, and you know, many of us have debated this over the years in context of the IMS learning design specification. For LAMS alone, though, we provide the integrations with a range of platforms for version 1, Blackboard, WebCT4, Moodle, Sakai, .learn, and it's really a kind of single sign-on integration. It just means it's easy for people to log straight into LAMS based off a link that's in the main VLE page. In terms of version 2, we have integrations out for both Moodle and Sakai. You can use those today. And we are updating the Blackboard building block as we speak. And we also have a WebCT power link coming out in the second half of this year. So I know many people have reached the point where they're saying, I would like to use LAMS in my university. It has to plug into my VLE. That's just the context in which I work. How do I do that? Well, we will continue to work hard to support that. And I want to give credit particularly to my host institution of Macquarie University, who've been enormously generous over many years with LAMS, have recently put in another component of funding to make that power link available for its own use, but also for everyone else. Some of the deeper integration is not yet been done, and it's one that's come up a few times today. Assessment integration is an interesting one, where LAMS will be able to report back that at least maybe the sequence has been completed, or to report back scores on quizzes and essays back into a gradebook within the VLE. There's been quite some discussion of this within the LAMS community in some of the technical forums, and we've scoped the work. We haven't yet actually done it, but it's something I hope that we'll see done, you know, in the not-too-distant future. The tools integration question, though, the idea that one could actually use the LAMS drag-and-drop environment to drag-and-drop your VLE's tools, remains possible. It's partly why we built the architecture like this to make that a possibility. But technically, it's still very challenging because effectively it means that the VLE's tools have to open themselves up to be orchestrated by a separate, you know, piece of software. And most VLEs still don't have the hooks, the components, to make that possible today. On the other hand, basically every major VLE has talked with me at some length about what it would take to do that, and so there is some interest in it. We haven't seen it yet. So we're keen to do it. We think it's a great idea for those who would like that, but it's a pretty significant piece of technical work, and so that remains my caution. For those of you who haven't seen one of these in operation, this is actually lambs running inside Sakai. So this is the instructor view in Sakai, where I can see a number of sequences that I have launched within a lambs area of my course. I have the ability to go in and monitor them and so on. When it comes to launching them, I can actually open up the sort of the list of sequences I have directly from Sakai, choose the one I want, and have that auto launch from Sakai. So you never actually go into LAMS monitoring to do that process. You can do that all directly from Sakai. If you wanted to do some authoring, you can pop open LAMS authoring environment straight from Sakai, do it, save it, and then you can pick up that new piece of work and run it back out of Sakai. The Moodle integration is exactly the same concept, so that's it. Alright, so the third thing I want to touch on today is a bit more about flexible learning design structures. And one of the quite justified negative commentaries on LAMS has been that it just doesn't have the breadth of structures that we need for teaching and learning. Now, there are certain types of teaching and learning where, you know, perhaps different students go off and do different tasks, or where you loop back to earlier tasks and reconsider them and so on. Just, you know, basic ways we go about doing teaching and learning that LAMS either couldn't do or was very hard to do within LAMS. And we are not deaf to these, you know, concerns. We have them too. And we hope over time to be able to give, you know, LAMS more and more flexibility to support a wider and wider range of pedagogies. And it turned out that, in fact, we had to do a huge amount of re-architecting on LAMS version 2 from the ground up to make these possible in the future. And so as we stand today, LAMS version 2's architecture will support things like branching and conditionality and advanced groups. Some of these things we've just not yet implemented the front end of it, the interface for people to see. One that I'm very excited that came out a month ago is what we call live edit, the ability to go in and edit a running design on the fly, change it, have it reinstantiate and go on. And this is one pedagogically critical. You know, it is very common that you are running a set of, you know, a lesson plan or a set of activities, you get halfway through it and you think, oh, you know, look, it's not going the way I thought, or the students have gone off in a different direction. I need to change what I'm going to do with them because of what's happened so far. Well, you know, that technology is now possible within LAMS as a result of this new feature. It was very difficult to do technically, but all credit to Ernie and the team, that's there and it now works. As for LAMS version 2.1, our next kind of major release, which we had hoped we might have out sort of for this conference, or at least in beta, not quite there yet, but we'll certainly have it out over the coming months and by the end of the year, has got these major new features of branching and also conditionality and what we call data in out in relation to branching. The ability to say, I want to look at the quiz scores from that previous tool to determine where people branch. And in the future, even more advanced things like the number of postings in this forum as a determinant of how people branch and so on. There's also, in addition to branching, and the ability that in the optional box, for those of you who know it, you can actually have a sequence of activities within an optional box, not just single tasks. And so you can say to students, here are three sequences you can choose on what you do next, and you might do two or even three of them. And then after you've been off and done them, then we'll come back to some unified tasks together. So what are sort of two different types of branching. One is an automated or a directed splitting of tasks. The other is here are a number of choices of whole sequences of tasks. Both of them are coming out quite soon. And then another one that's come up quite a lot is people say, look, there are sometimes when the linear sequence doesn't capture the fact that there are sort of supporting tasks that are not really in the sequence, but they are relevant at least for some students as a sort of something that sits alongside it. And so we're going to be adding a thing, we haven't got a good word for it yet, we call them floating activities, I'm not quite sure how to put them. But they will be activities that are not in the, you know, structured flow, but sit there as sort of additional supporting tasks. So that is also coming. Just a quick screenshot of live edit. This is a sequence that's running live. This is actually RAMS as it happens, but the same feature is now within LAMS. But I'm running this, there's a person who's got up to the second task. So when I hit live edit, what it does is it looks at the sequence and sees where is the person who's got the furthest in the sequence. I'll put a stop point immediately after them, and then you can edit any of the tasks that no one has yet got up to. If anyone's got to a task yet, it won't let you edit those so that you don't sort of suddenly change the environment that people are actually in. So you'll see here this special version of authoring where some of the tasks are being greyed out and the stop point's been put in, but I can now edit the four remaining tasks. And so let's say I decide to change it into a set of optional tasks. I can click the apply changes, and that will on the spot then change that sequence for that live set of students. And so now they would have this sequence to go through rather than the earlier one. So that's implemented, that's in the 2.0.3 release, so from here on in you can get that. Now, I want to try and do a branching demo. So this is the bit where the code is not quite stable, but let's see what happens. You're not allowed to give it away before I've done it. Right. One of the problems that we've hit with branching is that we don't have enough space on the screen to actually represent all of these sub-branches that you might do. And so at the moment what we're going to do is a kind of zoom in, zoom out mechanism. It doesn't fully show them, but we're hoping to do almost like a little tiny snapshot of what the branched bit looks like, so you will still see that on the page. So let's imagine I had a Q&A, and then I had some resources, and then I wanted to have a branch. So those of you who noticed that we had branch, in the interface grayed out in 2.0, because we had, it's now, in this case, actually there. So I'm going to drag out a branch, and so there it is. And so now when I click on branching, it actually pops up a kind of sub-area for creating the branches. And so we will have these kind of start and end points that you use. And so then if I want one branch which has got a notebook and then a chat, I want another branch where you do look at some resources and perhaps do a quiz. And perhaps in another one I just want a forum on its own. So this becomes possible now and allows us to do, different pathways for students. And those pathways can be done in a couple of ways. One is based on groupings that you already have. So if you already have students in groups, you can send certain groups down the branches. There will be the ability to use data from previous tools to automate a branching. So, quiz scores, if you've got 8 out of 10 or above, go on this branch. If you've got 6 to 8, go here and so on. And there will also be teacher directed, that the teacher can just say, this student goes there, this student goes there, and so on. As for student choice on branching, students won't have a choice in this particular version. But when we have the new optional box, where you can have a whole sequence in an optional box, then students will be able to choose in that context. So that's, I don't know if that's very much for you to see, but it killed us to get this far. So. Well, and let me be slightly more honest, it didn't kill me. Mr. Ernie and the technical team can, really take a bow for this work. All right, so the last thing I'd like to talk about for today is what I'm going to call the pedagogic turn for learning design. And to go back a step, one of the key drivers for learning design in the field has been trying to create flexible platforms that could do many types of pedagogies. And this has had various names, as Rob Copas talked about, this is a pedagogical meta model, or for learning design systems to aspire to being pedagogically neutral. And while these concepts have been controversial for some people, I think they're very important, this idea that we want to build platforms that could do many different kinds of pedagogies, and the platform needs to be flexible enough to support those. So I take that as a fundamental requirement for this field and one that's very important. However, many educators find the sort of blank canvas of, authoring, where do I start? What do I do? Couldn't you just give me something and I could work with that? And so in the work that Diana and Liz and others have been doing in pedagogic planners, and also Jeff, just a number of us have been coming at this from a few different angles, so trying to say, how do we add on a pedagogy layer to the use of learning design in a way that won't sort of corrupt the flexibility of the underlying systems and yet is useful to educators to both reflect on their teaching, to be giving them templates or other advice to help them go about doing it. And the way that I would describe this, and this has come up a number of times during today, is sort of, I'd like to see a lower level platform that can do lots of different things. I would like to see sort of some kind of full authoring environment on that, where you could create a wide range of pedagogies. But then for at least a subset of users, we want to give them good practice templates and some more limited authoring, where they only need to fill in perhaps a little bit of detail. And that the templates that they get to through some sort of reflective process like the London and Phoebe pedagogic planners to think through issues, and then we perhaps recommend a small set of examples that people could use. Now, I should say, if you go into these templates and you don't like the limited authoring, you could still pull it up in full authoring, as long as you're willing to deal with all of that complexity. But I'm also keen that we get to a point in learning design where we could have the next generation of teachers start using it, who might never see the full LAMS authoring environment in their, certainly in their early use. They would just see a number of good templates, fill in a bit of detail, and then be able to run those. So what I want to show you is a couple of early mock-ups we've been doing, and this is not live running software, this is just mock-ups, but we're keen for feedback on where we should take this work, and we are going to implement it in software over the coming months. But there are two of these mock-ups that we've got. So let me just get it. The URL for these is on my slides, so you can look at them in detail later on, but I want to just pick out a few bits of it. That we'd have a new area of LAMS separate from authoring, which we're currently calling an activity planner. We're not quite sure what to call it. But the top part of the screen is what your typical teacher might see, and that is sort of a number of small collections of templates that they could use depending on how they want to think through the process. And so this might be where you pass off from a bigger pedagogic planner down to choose a particular teaching style. The bottom bit I'll come back to in a moment. But the educator is able to go in and pick one of these areas and then be given sort of a number of possible pre-designed templates. So here we've got a problem-based learning template and a case study and a role play, and so these have been pre-configured by an expert with most of the settings already in place. They can find out some information about these templates, sort of, you know, what they're good for and so on, and in fact could go off and get, you know, much more detailed information, a whole website if they like. This is reminiscent of some of Phoebe's work about finding out more of details. The point here though is that ultimately as you look at these and you start to think, well, you know, this looks like one I'd like to choose, you would then come to a screen where it might have, you know, a small number of pre-built specific templates. In this case, one starts with resources, one starts with discussion. You could preview that using the standard preview function, so you can actually see what would students see when they use this template, so I can get a bit of a feel for what it's about. But most importantly, once I've looked at that as an educator and thought, yeah, that looks like a template I would like to use, this is the key screen. And so what we've done here is we've got the sequence running down the page. We have actually abstracted out generally only a single field that needs to be filled in by the educator. So if it's the question and answer tool, we've preset the title, we've preset all the advanced settings, and all you fill in is, what's your question? That's it. When it comes down the bottom, share resources. So we preset all these bits of share resources, and all you do is upload the document or put in the URL for the website you want to look at. And so that's all that our instructor, our lecturer, is required to do to use this template. They don't need to know about all the settings that are behind the scene. They don't need to understand the whole LAMS authoring environment. We've tried to, in a sense, capture, as Diana put it this morning, the generic activity structure is already here, and now you're just putting in the learning objects or the content dimension that you as a discipline specialist would know most about to apply this template to your area. So that's one half of the work. So that's what an educator would see, and I say we've got this little, you know, help on the side where we also would have things like advice on how to fill out this box. So if it's a Q&A box, how should you write the question? What are some advice on writing the question? Perhaps what are some, you know, samples of the wording you should use? So not even just a template, but some more help. So that's half of what we're doing with pedagogic planners. The other half is we want to try and find a way to help expert educational designers to create these pedagogic planners and share them with each other, or activity planners. My apologies, we still haven't got a good word. So down the bottom here is the idea that if you're an expert, this would not be available to your average teacher, but you can actually upload these decision processes, you can upload template files, you can create the kind of template you saw. So I'll just run through this very briefly for the moment. So what you would do is you as an expert designer would go into full LAMS authoring, you would author a set of activities, and you would set all the settings that you expect this template needs preset and that a typical teacher who's going to use it will not need to touch. So you put in things like a nice generic title in the title field, you know, if there's an introductory notice board with just, we're going to do a role play and here's some things to think about, you'd write some generic text which would work for sort of any role play, and so that they wouldn't need to edit those. So we've done that, we've filled out the text. Sorry, this will take a few seconds to do. So in this sense, creating a template looks just like creating a normal sequence within LAMS. That's example of. Okay, so then we're going to save it though as a kind of template shell rather than as a just a standard LAMS learning design. And then the critical bit of new technology we're going to have to build is this interface. It's going to be a special kind of interface that you effectively read the template into, and it will generate this view where it only gives you, you know, sort of one field per tool to fill in. And initially we'll have to design that and sort of hardwire what those are. In the medium to long term, we'd actually hope that you could design what fields pop up. So you actually go into and designate, oh, I want this field to pop up. That's a little bit far away. For now, we'll just have this kind of cut down thing. And then the checkboxes are that you can actually say some of the tools you want to lock and have them not edit at all, but the ones you leave open are the ones that the educator's going to be able to do something. You'll also be able to edit the need help text, you know, some advice to them on how to do it. Okay, so that's where we are currently up to in our thinking about a sort of activity planner. We see this as hopefully complementary to the more comprehensive pedagogic planners that a number of people are working on, and want to work out the best way to link between these. So. Let me now conclude to just summarise those four points. I think that these representational frameworks for teaching and learning is in many ways the heart of what we're doing here. And I'm heartened that music only took several hundred years to get this right. So if we're struggling today and it looks like it might take a decade, that might be all right. I mean, we may be old and grey, but it might be a hard thing to get right, and it might take a lot of work. Nonetheless, I think it's critical to this field. This technology challenge of building learning design systems in general has been, you know, one, and we've done quite a bit of work on LAMS version 2. There are many implications of that, but one in particular is, if you do now find bugs, please tell us, because we're keen to fix them, and we want to see it become more and more stable and robust with time. It's quite different to the old one. We've got new flexibility that's coming in the system, you know, in the near future, and we hope that that will address some of the concerns people have had about LAMS not having enough range of flexibility in terms of pedagogy. You know, it still won't have everything, but it will hopefully add a bit more. And finally, we're still keen to see what's the best way to provide these activity planners to both provide them and to allow others to create them as a component of the wider sort of planner environment. So I will perhaps stop at that point. The way we're going to conclude the conference was to invite Diana and Simon and I to sort of grab a seat at the front, and then for us to throw open for discussion, questions, you know, anything that you'd like to talk about before we end. So shall we...